Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, music and memory. We'll take a trip around the world with the retro sound of Pink Martini.
The band is really a cross between, if you were to cross the Lawrence Welk show with the Muppet Show, and maybe laugh in, and maybe all set it in the United Nations of 1962 lobby.
And some new science explains those dreaded snippets of song that burrow into your brain. Earworms.
About 25% report experiencing them several times a day.
But first, remembering Kurt Cobain, the voice of his generation. April 5th marks the 20th anniversary of Cobain's suicide at age 27. He had a history of depression and chronic pain, a heroin addiction, and a complicated relationship with fame. Charles Cross is the author of the definitive Cobain biography, Heavier Than Heaven, and he's just released a new book called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Charles, can you take me back to how you found out about Kurt Cobain's death?
I was the editor of a magazine called The Rocket, which was a biweekly music and entertainment magazine in the Northwest. And I was sitting in my office on April 8th, 1994, and got a phone call from someone at a local radio station, and the words out of his mouth were, "Do you think it's possible Kurt Cobain is dead?" And that radio station had just gotten a call from, bizarrely, an electrical contractor who'd been installing some stuff in Kurt's house, and the police had just then been called, and the station was calling me to see if I potentially could confirm it or if I knew anything.
And you hadn't known anything at that point?
Of course, no one knew anything. Everyone knew Kurt was struggling with drugs. That was no secret in Seattle or anywhere in the world at that point. And he obviously had had Rome just a month before, which, even though it was reported as a drug overdose, there were already rumors and talk that it was a suicide attempt. The words out of my mouth to the radio station were, no, it couldn't possibly be Kurt. And I think that was just denial to some degree. But it was a slight truth, I guess, in that I knew some of Kurt's friends, and many of them, frankly, were worse off than Kurt in terms of their drug problems. And I just thought it had to be one of his buddies. It just simply couldn't be him. But it certainly was him, and we think he died on April 5th.
Of course, it turned out that Kurt Cobain didn't die of a drug overdose. He died from a shotgun. What was your reaction when you found out?
Well, obviously, his suicide was incredibly shocking, and his choice of death to shoot himself with a shotgun was unbelievably horrific. In researching his life later as his biographer, what I found out was that that was one of probably a dozen suicide attempts, and if you actually look at his drug addiction and how many times he overdosed on drugs, those, to some degree, you can also call sort of a suicide attempt, or at least a choice to put yourself in a reckless disregard for living. This was part of a pattern, but his death was just so horrible. It truly is one of the most horrible days of my life. It certainly is the most horrible day of Seattle music ever. For anybody that was a Nirvana fan, it was unbelievably heartbreaking. And whether you were a fan of Nirvana or not, a celebrity of that stature choosing to take his own life at the height of his fame was enough to make you take notice. I do think that plays some role in Kurt's enduring legacy, and it is one of the reasons we're still talking about him 20 years after his death.
Well, we should talk about his legacy. I mean, it's been 20 years now since he died, and you have a book out on the 20th anniversary of his death, and the subtitle of your book is The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. What do you see as his legacy? Why does he still matter?
Well, in the book, I outline five or six different areas where you can kind of measure his impact. But by far and away, music is the way his impact has had the biggest shadow.
Especially on alternative music. Nirvana and Kurt Cobain, I mean, they really shifted the way alternative music was performed, right?
Well, I would go beyond that, and I would say they had a major impact on shifting all of music. In some ways, they made the genre of alternative even happen, but I think their impact was almost larger. Alternative rock, there were Sonic Youth and there were a number of other alternative rock bands that had had some level of success before Nirvana. But what happened is that mainstream music changed. The music that was on top 40 radio changed after Nirvana, not just the music that was on college radio stations or on alternative stations. In some ways, Nirvana's music, which let's just take Smells Like Teen Spirit and say it's an aggressive sounding song, they made pop music become more aggressive.
So explain that for me. Why was this such a great album? Never mind.
Well, I argue it's a great album to some degree because it is. We can kind of look at the critical reputation, and there is a point where for a record to have both that level of commercial success and over time be ranked so high in critics' polls, maybe there actually is some truth. I quote Occam's razor in the book. Sometimes the simplest answer to any problem is the answer that's right before you. To me personally as a listener, the reason that it's a great record is that the songwriting is just incredible. Listen to Smells Like Teen Spirit, read the lyrics, and you'll be blown away by Kurt's artistry. But I also think sonically that you listen to Smells Like Teen Spirit, and before Kurt even sings, it's a great song. That drum beat that Dave Grohl pounds out starting that song is just unstoppable. Kurt wrote very, very catchy songs, but he also had a great band. He had a great producer. Everything came together on that record. Every single piece of that album, from the album cover to the name of the band to the name of the album, it all just was absolutely perfect and perfectly timed. Smells Like Teen Spirit changed the entire template for what a hit pop song could be, even on alternative rock. It's a hit. It has that undefinable essence of hitdom. The voice, the melodies, the contrast, everything about that song is a hit. But prior to 1991, there were never hits like that on the radio.
Now, it would seem, in retrospect, certainly, that Kurt Cobain had a hard time handling success. I mean, he was suddenly huge. He was monstrously popular, and then his life just spiraled downhill.
Well, he did have a hard time handling success, but at the same point, he had a hard time handling life when he wasn't successful. He just simply had a hard time handling life. You know, that's an argument that often gets bantered around. Did fame cause Kurt's death? If MTV hadn't played his song so much, and if he hadn't become so popular, would he be alive today? I think that the truth is that Kurt struggled way before he ever became famous, and that many of the things that were present in his life, depression, physical pain, a tendency towards addiction, a very difficult family upbringing, all of those things were true before he ever picked up a guitar and before he ever was on MTV. And if fame were the only problem in his life, he certainly could have retreated from the fame and quit. You know, that is possible. But I think there was a whole number of different psychological things at play that sort of led to, ultimately, his decision to take his own life.
Of course, we can never know why someone chooses to commit suicide, but what's your best guess as to why he chose to kill himself?
Well, I think it traces to the physical pain that he had dealt with during much of his life. That, more than anything, I think leads to hopelessness among people when someone has chronic pain that they don't feel like that they can get an answer to.
What was the chronic pain he was dealing with?
He had chronic stomach pain that had haunted him for most of his adult life. And he also had chronic back pain, and he certainly had chronic depression and chronic psychological pain. You add all of that mix together, and then you put the issues that are complicated by his addiction into there, and you get a very toxic mix.
His addiction to heroin in particular?
Exactly. But one thing that I think that it is interesting to note, that there were a number of people that I interviewed for Heavier Than Heaven who were friends of Kurt, who grew up with him in that world, and several of them are dead from either suicide or drug addiction now. And these are people that never had an album out and never were on the cover of Rolling Stone. These problems are not just about his fame or about his career choice. They are a result of a whole complicated series of things. Some of it, frankly, is being from a socioeconomic world that Kurt was from in Aberdeen that gave people less choices and made suicide an option that was more talked about. And the suicide rates are certainly higher in some of those communities.
You describe Kurt Cobain as the last true rock star. What makes you think that?
I hope there are other rock stars. I hope he's not the last. But to this point in time, there hasn't been anybody that quite has had that singular focus in their songwriting. There have been other great rock stars, but there hasn't been rock star, capital rock, and also a star that it isn't just about the commercial success. It's about their artistic statement. I think ultimately that's one reason we're still talking about Kurt, is that that songwriting skill that he brought to everything he did, that voice, not just his vocals, the sheer curtness that was in every song he wrote, that charisma, that undefinable star quality, we haven't seen that in one person in rock in the last 20 years.
Charles Cross is the author of Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. And as long as we're talking about Cobain's lasting influence, his name is cropping up in some unexpected places these days.
For everything there was a time, I'm stealthy, I'm mentally taking your wealth. I happen to be an MC that cannot be defeated by anyone else. See, I'm at the top, I gotta get you an office, you aspirin for the fame. Wait, your style's our lane.
And one of the surprises I had when I was reading your book is I hadn't realized how influential Kurt Cobain has been on the hip-hop world. He's just quoted all the time, actually.
I hadn't realized it either, frankly, before I began researching the book. But absolutely, Kurt has had a huge impact in hip-hop. He has been sampled significantly. He has become a figure in lyrics of a number of hip-hop songs.
Spit that Kurt Vonnegut, that blow your brain, Kurt Cobain, that Nirvana.
And even though the music that he did has very little, at least on paper, to do with hip-hop, he's become influential. And that is a bizarre outcome that I maybe never would have predicted. I mean, the ultimate symbol of that is the song that came out from Jay-Z just this last year called Holy Grail, which not only name checks Kurt, but it also samples Smells Like Teen Spirit.
I know nobody to blame. Kurt Cobain did it to myself.
And then here in the weirdest thing that maybe ever has happened in Nirvana's career, at the Grammy Awards this year, Kurt Cobain was nominated in the best rap song category or included in it. You know, he was one of a number of nominations because the lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit were part of that song's composition. He lost, I think, to Macklemore, if I'm remembering correctly, another Seattle artist, but he was nominated in that category, which is truly bizarre.
Charles Cross is the author of Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Don't know why.
Coming up, you know how when you find a new song you like, you want to hear it over and over and over again? It turns out not only do we like our music on repeat, repetition is music. We'll find out why. And the globally nostalgic, or nostalgically global, sound of Pink Martini. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about music and memory in this hour. And did you know that 90% of the music we listen to is music we've heard before? We like to think that we've got adventurous taste in music, but turns out what we really crave is repetition. In fact, to a certain extent, repetition is what turns random sound into music. Elizabeth Margulis directs the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and she's the author of On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. She'd like to correct a common misconception that music is a kind of language.
Music is not really like a language. So, I mean, it's one of those metaphors that's really out there. As I was growing up, I went to Interlochen Arts Camp over the big stage there. They have it emblazoned in large letters. Music is the universal language. But maybe there are some things going on in music that aren't really the same as what's going on in language. I'll give you some examples, maybe. When we think back to what happened in a story somebody told us, we tend to remember the gist of what happened, not the specific words they used to tell the story to us. Mm-hmm. But if we try to remember back to a song we listened to or a piece we really enjoyed, there's something about the actual specific sequence of notes that is still very present and verbatim in our memory, and in fact, really gripping.
So you don't necessarily remember the overall plot or shape of a Beethoven concerto, but you could probably hum some of your favorite bars.
That's exactly right. So there's a great example that Mark DeBellis uses in a book he wrote called Conceptualizing Music, where he asks, if you think about the Star Spangled Banner, right, and you think, okay, the word O and the word U, were those sung on the same pitch? And really, to answer that question, what you have to do is go back in and sing through the tune.
I just did it in my head while you were talking.
Yeah, you can't just duck in and get to one little snippet. They're all welded together so tightly in your mind that one note seems to just kind of inevitably spill out of the preceding one. And I think that tight connection from note to note is really an effect that is created through repetition.
Hmm. One of the most interesting things you point out is the connection between repetition, music, and speech. And there's this speech-to-song illusion that somebody named Diana Deutsch came up with. Maybe you could explain it.
Sure. Diana Deutsch is a psychologist at the University of California at San Diego. And the illusion, actually, the one that's most famous, involves her own voice speaking. And what you hear is simply an utterance, just a regular spoken utterance. And then you hear a snippet from that repeated a number of times.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
And then what you need to do is just go back and listen to the original utterance again.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
And for many people, for about 85% of people, you experience a remarkable perceptual shift where at the moment you get to the little clause that's been repeated, it sounds like Diana Deutsch has bust into song in the style of a Disney musical. It's really quite stunning because it's the exact same acoustic signal. So what has changed is the perceptual apparatus we're bringing to understand it, not anything about the sound itself.
Yeah, I didn't hear it as busting into a great big Disney musical, but it did sound as though she she sang that little section of speech a little bit more. And still, I went away from it thinking, I don't know, that's not such a dramatic difference. And then I was walking down the hallway and I found myself humming that little tiny bit
of
her speech.
It'll get you every time.
It did. It became an earworm. What's going on in our brains that makes them convert repeated speech, you know, just a few words repeated, into music?
Well, maybe the easiest way to start thinking about that is to think about a different illusion that we've known about for much longer. This one comes from Severance and Washburn more than 100 years ago, and it's called the semantic satiation effect. What you do here is you just grab a patient friend and you ask them to repeat a word to you again and again and again for about a minute. And over the course of that minute, some trippy things start to happen. Normally, when you hear a word in a language you speak, it's pretty hard not to just feel the word as a transparent window into its semantic correlate. So if I say light bulb, for example, you know, you picture the little glowing object. But if I say light bulb to you 75 times, it loses its connection to the real world object it typically denotes. And instead, you become hyper attentive to small little subtle things about the word. Like you notice that the L sound returns twice, or that the B is this strange kind of acoustic burst. It's really quite strange. It's as if the sound has devolved into nonsense. And it's something you really hear rather than something that you think about and notice. It's a salient change in just the basic way you're experiencing the sound.
So could you turn any sound into music just by repeating it?
That's a great question, because lots of people, when they first hear that example of the speech-to-song illusion, they say, oh, well, she has this lovely British accent, and it's all very melodic, and, you know, maybe the deck was stacked in her favor. We do have really interesting data that show that you can take speech, repeat it, make it seem more musical. In my lab, for example, we took random sequences of sounds, repeated them, caused those to sound more musical to people. But that's not to say that you can record something in your basement, send it to some top 40 radio station, and become the mega hit superstar Justin Bieber of tomorrow.
In other words, there's repetition and then there's repetition. And it also depends on what you're choosing to repeat.
That's right. I mean, there's so much other stuff going on. I'm simply saying that there's this practice that's at the bottom and kind of giving air to all of these other musical features, which is putting them on repeat. Just that this is an agent of musicalization, but it's not the only game in town.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Love, don't hurt me. No more.
So we've been talking about the kind of repetition that's pleasurable in music. Of course, there's another kind that's not so pleasurable. There's a phenomenon, we tend to call it the earworm these days. You know, that piece of music that gets stuck in your head and you just can't get it out, and it can get really irritating. Is that another kind of musical repetition?
That's true, because earworms, I mean, if you think about them, they could have been luxurious. They could just be our own personal life soundtrack, right? But the thing is, they don't work that way. It's not that you get a song stuck in your head and the whole thing goes through accompanying your run or something, then you wouldn't need an iPod. Unfortunately, what happens with an earworm typically is that a fragment of that music gets stuck in your head. And not only is it just this little fragment, but it plays through on repeat. So even in our own minds, when we're imagining music, and sometimes involuntarily, we're stuck in this kind of repetitive sequencing that is so characteristic of the way we experience and use music in the world.
Does everybody have that experience? Does everyone get earworms?
Well, there have been some interesting studies recently trying to look at exactly how common this experience is. It seems to be that more than 90% of people report experiencing them at least once a week.
So, wow, once a week.
Yeah, and that's a lot of people. But this is maybe even more surprising. About a fourth of people report, so 25%, report experiencing them several times a day.
Oh my God, several times a day. That's a
Can
lot.
Can you imagine?
That's like musical torture.
And it seems to be associated with musical aptitude or musical behavior. So the more you play music and are involved with music in your life, the more susceptible you tend to be to earworms as well.
Where did that concept even come from?
You know, it's fun because so many different languages have their own funny expressions for the earworm. In some places, their name translates to tormenting songs or other horrible things. But they've been around for a long time, we know, because Mark Twain wrote a short story about this sinister earworm that overtook an entire town even before the gramophone had been invented and disseminated. So wow, we know that this was happening even before technology perhaps made it even likelier.
Elizabeth Margulis directs the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and she's the author of On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. Speaking of music and repetition, there's a band we love called Pink Martini. It's famous for a sound that's both deeply nostalgic and still somehow new. Pianist Thomas Lauderdale formed Pink Martini 20 years ago in Portland, Oregon. He was working in politics, thinking about running for mayor one day, and increasingly irritated by the music he heard at political fundraisers. Loud and boring is how he describes it. So he created his own little orchestra and began making sophisticated, old-fashioned pop and jazz with an international flavor. Doug Gordon talked with Lauderdale about what makes that Pink Martini sound.
You've described the band's eclectic repertoire as being a bit like an urban musical travelogue. That's such a lovely phrase. Can you elaborate on that?
It's like a sort of a rollicking around the world adventure. The band's repertoire is sort of like music of the world without being world music. When one thinks of world music, one thinks sort of almost a folk kind of thing. This is really more urban, nighttime, kind of cosmopolitan, almost cinematic in a way. The band is really a cross between, if you were to cross the Lawrence Welk show with the Muppet show, and maybe laugh in, and maybe all set it in the United Nations of 1962 lobby.
Do you see 1962 as being a particularly significant year in terms of world music?
Well, it was the year my parents got married, and they were really from the earnest side of the 60s. They met at Purdue in 1962. Actually, if I were to go back to college, I would do my thesis on the year 1964. Within 1 year of the death of John F. Kennedy, I think that there was a certain kind of optimism that totally vanished within a year of his death. And one can see it in all kinds of ways. 1964 was the year of the last sort of great optimistic American film, which actually, I think, happens to be The Sound of Music. 1964 is the last year that silver was actually in the actual currency. It was there, and then suddenly, after 64, it became something else, which represented, but it wasn't real. I think that things became more plastic after 1964. The American products, which before were sort of indestructible, whether it was a Ford car or a Polaroid land camera, became immensely plastic and throwawayable. Is that a word?
It is now. Anything you say is a word as far as I'm concerned. You're an American band from Portland, Oregon, but you spend a lot of time performing around the world. Do you see Pink Martini as being kind of a musical diplomat?
Absolutely. It's amazing because, like, in the 1950s, especially early 1960s, American artists, American bands, American singers sang a lot of songs in different languages. Connie Francis, for example, who's still alive, did whole albums in German and Hebrew and Italian and Spanish. And then there were people like Dinah Shore, the American talk show host of the 60s and 70s, who in 1965, she sang in 8 different languages on national television on a 1-hour salute to the Peace Corps. Despite the Cold War, there was this kind of general curiosity about the world. I can't think of an example of any time in the last 20 years that there was a song sung in a different language besides English on national television.
Your singer, China Forbes, is only fluent in English, yet she's able to sing so convincingly in all these different languages. I think she's sung in like 15 different languages. How does she do this?
China also speaks French and Italian.
Okay.
One of the things about China that's amazing, you know, we went to college together. We were in the same college dormitory at Harvard, and she was the queen of the dining hall. She would entertain all of us for hours and hours and hours with her accents and her never-ending monologues, which were hysterically funny. So she's always been an incredible mimic and has an incredible ear, so she hears all of the subtleties in language. In regards to learning new songs, we always find a professor of that language or an expert and then go for it. And she's able to really sing convincingly in 20 different languages.
The latest Pink Martini album is Get Happy. It's your sixth studio album, and one of many standout tracks is a cover version of Kate and Anna McGarrigle's Kitty Come Home, and it's sung by Rufus Wainwright, who, of course, is the son of Kate McGarrigle and Loudon Wainwright III. What drew you to this song?
I've always liked Kitty Come Home, and for the first 5 years that I was listening to Kitty Come Home, I thought it was sort of a plea to a cat that was missing. You know, I met Rufus Wainwright in 1995 or 1996 when he first came to Portland to do his first show. 5 years sort of into our friendship, he revealed that it was written by his aunt, that song, as a plea to her sister, Kitty, Kate McGarrigle, Rufus's mother, to bring her children, Rufus and Martha, back to Canada and leave Loudon. And so it became this even more devastating song with much more meaning. I always thought that the song itself was so gorgeous, and with this additional meaning, it was like unbelievably heartbreaking. And so I helped coordinate a performance that Rufus did with the Oregon Symphony about 4 years ago and asked him if he would consider singing that song with the orchestra. And so he did, and it was so beautiful. And then when it came time to recording this particular album, I gathered the gumption and called Rufus to see if he would consider recording a song for it. I said, this is really your turf, this is your family history and all of that, so I understand if you would say no, but would you consider recording Kitty Come Home?
No scheme and no direction, with only one way to turn. Pack up all your children, come home to our love and concern. Kitty, come home.
We had a first career really in Europe more than we had one in the U.S. In the years following, we started playing with symphony orchestras. And, you know, with a band this size, which is 10 to 12 people playing this sort of improbable music, it doesn't really even seem plausible that it would work. It's very compatible with a symphonic milieu. We played with 50 different orchestras across the country. It made it possible for us to actually have a career in the U.S. Between that, NPR, and Starbucks, which commissioned our holiday album, we've been able to really travel in the United States. It's not the kind of band where you get stoned and go down in one gigantic van and sleep on people's couches. Like, it's never really been that.
No, and especially now with the band having tripled in size, right? Because originally there were 4 members, and now you're up to 12, correct?
Right. And sometimes an additional 4, and sometimes we travel with even other. It's better to have more people than fewer. If we were a band of 4 still, the band would have broken up a long time ago. But by having a larger band, it disperses the bad energy. So if somebody's fighting with somebody, you can always talk to somebody else.
Yeah, because there are enough people. Say, I hadn't thought of that. That's a very good point.
Pink Martini's leader, Thomas Lauderdale, was talking with producer Doug Gordon. The group's most recent album is called Get Happy and features a guest artist you might recognize, NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro. That's it for the conversation about music and memory. But coming up, Richard Power's new novel, Orfeo, is on our minds this week, along with a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Sam Criss, and I'm a writer. My dangerous idea is that pleasantness isn't just boring, it's evil. Calls for pleasantness and affirmation are everywhere. We're constantly told that our political discourse needs to be more civil and refined, that we should listen to opposing ideas and not resort to petty name-calling. Some of the most popular books on sale are self-help books, the type that encourage you to deal with life's little obstacles in an upbeat manner so that you can find your way to a state of perfect happiness. The message everywhere is that if we just tried to get along better and understand one another more, we could all be happier and more productive. Perhaps the best example of all this is the artwork of George W. Bush. Early in 2013, it was revealed that the former president and serious contender for the most hated man on earth has, since leaving office, taken up painting as a hobby. Afterwards, there are a couple of critical pieces on his nude self-portraits. They all ask the same questions. What do these paintings tell us about George W. Bush's inner life, or his psychology, or his presidency? They've all got it backwards. If you follow that line, you'll only ever end up with trite, reductive analogies. The running water represents Hurricane Katrina, or Bush's need to atone for his crimes, or his fear of death. It's a vaguely amusing parlor game, but not much more. If you want to know the truth, there's no point looking at Bush's self-portraits. You have to look at his paintings of dogs. George W. Bush has produced 50 paintings of dogs. In other words, one painting of a dog for every US soldier killed in Afghanistan during his presidency, or one painting of a dog for every 2,237 civilians killed in Iraq since the invasion. His paintings of dogs are all quite pleasant. They're cute dogs, making adorable sad eyes depicted in bright colors. Spend enough time looking at them, and it all starts to make sense. The war in Iraq was little more than the geopolitical expression of kitschy sentimentality. Imperialist universalism is a logic of the dog painting extended to nations and peoples. Radical evil is a weaponization of bad taste. We'll be greeted as liberators, the logic goes. Of course we will. We love our dogs. The incredible violence buried in Bush's dog paintings is also present in all positive and affirmational pleasantness. We're living in a world that is spiraling into catastrophe. The logic of profit and exchange isn't only tearing up the foundations of social life, reducing us to anonymous, atomized blips in constant competition with one another. It's also threatening the continuation of biological life on the planet. In such a situation, the idea that a few simple life lessons can help us to be happier and less stressed is nothing short of monstrous. It's like standing atop a pile of corpses and suggesting they might be arranged more pleasantly. If we all got along better and were nicer to each other, we might make more progress. But the problem is that we're progressing in precisely the wrong direction. This stuff is dangerous and needs to be fought with every weapon available, with all the puerile and tasteless fury we can muster. And perhaps the best way to start is by being just a little more unpleasant to everyone we meet.
All right. Writer Sam Criss with A Dangerous Idea. You'll find more dangerous ideas, including another one from Criss, on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, it's always news when there's a new Richard Powers novel out. If you aren't familiar with him, Powers writes big novels. not just long, but cerebral, packed full of big ideas and scientific themes like artificial intelligence, game theory, musicology, and genetic recombination. He's won both a National Book Award and a MacArthur Genius Award. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about his brand new novel, Orfeo.
Richard, how would you describe your main character, Peter Ells?
Well, he's a boy who has a gift with pattern. He is enchanted by chemistry, by physics, by mathematics, but he's also gifted at music. He's a clarinetist of some skill. The common denominator that unites all those interests is this ability to find pattern, surprise inside the predictable. And it's this response to architecture, in a way, the architecture of science, the architecture of music, that drives him, that gives him his primary passion. He doesn't understand people quite as well as he does shapes and forms. And it's perhaps that sets him down the road, ultimately, to search for a music beyond the ability of the ear to hear yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should talk about how we meet Peter Ells at the beginning of the book. By this point, he's 70 years old, a retired music professor, a one-time avant-garde classical music composer. And he kind of has this audacious project that he's trying to encode music and insert it into living organisms?
Yes, after a lifetime throwing his fate in with the avant-garde in pursuit of ever more exotic music, stranger sounds, less predictable patterns, searching for music in surprising places, he actually follows music down into the repeating patterns of nucleotides in the cell and comes up with this idea, a kind of last hurrah, if you will, having spent the life writing the kind of music where there are more people up on stage than there are in the audience, figures that perhaps there might be a poetic final gesture in which he could create a kind of music, encode it into base four, send away to a mail order house and have it converted into a nucleotide string, and find a way of placing this musical cassette for safekeeping into a replicating bacterium where it would be everywhere and surround people, but that no one would be able to hear it.
So Peter Ells decides to do something kind of crazy. He sets up a science lab in his house. I mean, basically sends away through the mail for these various kits, as test tubes around his house, trying to create this music that he's going to insert into bacteria. And then the local police find out about it, and Homeland Security gets interested, and they think, oh, you know, maybe we have a bioterrorist on our hands.
That's right. There's something more than a little suspicious about a 70-year-old retired avant-garde composer with the home biology lab. The story was inspired by the 2004 event involving the Buffalo bioartist Steve Kurtz. Kurtz was a performing artist who often used biological materials, and after the death of his wife, was found to have a house full of suspicious biological material. And even though he could immediately prove that the material was for a museum exhibition just a few weeks away, the police did hold him. He was briefly imprisoned and wasn't entirely freed and dropped of all charges for another 4 years. And it was this sense of art colliding with the security state that really inspired me. Although it took some years for me to realize how to put this into a fictional form that could become not just a meditation on the culture of fear, but also on the fear of culture, this sort of lifelong struggle of one artist to create an art that was both inviting and subversive, troubling, but tapped into this long tradition of countercultural art.
Now, it would seem that this whole idea that this kind of avant-garde artist would be a terrorist is absurd. Peter Ells just looks like an eccentric old music professor playing with his science toys in his house. But is this something we should consider? I mean, that Peter Ells perhaps really is a bioterrorist?
I suppose we see what we want to see. And in a culture as jittery as ours, the evidence is there for the asking. The do-it-yourself biology movement is fairly widespread. I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people tinkering with genetic manipulation in amateur labs across the country. Practitioners of do-it-yourself biology have frequently come into contact with law enforcement and security. So this question of how absurd is it to feel that an artist might actually be threatening the safety of a country, it's the kind of stuff that appeals innately to my novelistic impulse, but it's also the kind of stuff that has all too frequently been a matter of news.
Hmm. It seems like you're also asking the question, especially because you're invoking so much avant-garde art, can art itself ever really be shocking anymore? I mean, can art terrify?
That's the question of the 20th century. Really, the book takes that question as a meditation on this counterstream in music that so profoundly displaced concert music throughout those 100 years. And from the beginning of the century, where a work like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring could produce violent riots in the streets of Paris, to the early 21st century, where all of us are so inundated by 10 million recorded tracks of music and can hear everything ever recorded from anywhere at any time and can't really listen through long enough to be particularly shocked or subverted. It's this attempt to renew music's ability to surprise, even in a time where we've seen everything, that I think really underwrites Els's pursuit.
Well, I have to ask you about something that the German composer Stockhausen said, which got him into a lot of trouble a few days after 9/11, commenting on the terrorist acts of that day. He said, in his words, this was the greatest work of art imaginable for the whole cosmos. I mean, essentially, he was saying this was a performance piece that not only killed thousands of people, it changed the way the world thinks. And of course, this is a totally outrageous thing to say, but I have to ask you, do you agree with Stockhausen?
Well, it was an outrageous thing to say, and I do allude to that notorious statement at the end of the book. Stockhausen spent a long time afterwards trying to qualify and contextualize his statement. The question of whether a terrorist attack can be art is a profound one, and it's not an easily answered one. And there are many artists who have wanted to create a kind of terror as part of their expression. Obviously, a line is crossed when lives are taken, when property is destroyed. But I think what Stockhausen was getting at is this notion that the human impulse to create an effect in another person, to send a message that can transform history, is shared by terrorists and artists alike.
Now, we've been talking a lot about music, and the other thing that you do so much in a lot of your novels is you write about science. It might be neuroscience or artificial intelligence, or in this case, genetic engineering. Why do you keep coming back to science in your fiction?
Well, for many reasons. It's where we live. If you want to tell the story of who we are and where we've been set down and what life is like, it's not enough to pretend that we're just these social machines who are concerned basically with making friends and finding love. The way that we do that has been changed completely by the changes in time and space that we've worked through these scientific and technological transformations of the world. The luxury of creating a self and the way in which that self can be made is very much the story of these incredible prosthetic devices and these deep changes in our sense of the human that have been brought about by scientific and technological discoveries.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the creation of the self is the subject of so much great literature. It sounds like you're saying that to really talk about that intelligently now, you have to deal with the science because it tells us so much about how a self is made or perceived.
That's right. The creation of the self is still the subject of my books and still the subject of most fiction. But I think if you historicize this question, what is the relationship between the self and technology, you see that the great works of all periods are inflected by the technologies of their day. The trouble that Madame Bovary gets herself into can only come about in a world with the railroad, for instance, you know, and you know, that great bugaboo that, that Flaubert loved to hate. And you can look at Proust and his exploration of this world at the turn between the 19th and 20th century and see that his fascination with the telephone and the airplane are really the bellwethers of an understanding that these devices are changing the way that we understand the capacity of individual human beings.
You know, I have to ask you, I mean, a lot of people talk these days about how the modern world has become disenchanted in this age of science and rationality, and there's sort of this hunger for re-enchanting the world. Is that important to you?
What's important to me is finding a way to marshal and preserve enough attention, enough focus, to realize that there is far more magic in the world now than there ever was.
Richard Powers is the award-winning author of 11 novels. Steve Paulson talked with him about his newest, Orfeo. Richard Powers doesn't just write beautifully, he reads gorgeously. There's a section of Orfeo that's inspired by a piece of music by Mahler, and we wanted to hear that passage set to the Mahler. The result is pretty wonderful, and you can hear it too. It's on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Stephanie Youngblood, and Raymond Tungakar. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.